The Shamans of the Internal World. The Mountains Reply to the Volcar by Li Bai. They ask me where's the sense on Jasper Mountains. I laugh and don't reply in heart's own quiet. Peach Pete Hill float their streams away in secret to other skies and earths than those of mortals. The magic of this poem by Li Bai refer to a world that is unknown in its beginning and end. Its skies and earths are not of mortals. They belong to space and are like time, a secret sense that belongs to all beings, floating in a never-ending dream of shared belonging, impossible to grasp for all the right reasons. This dream, however, has disappeared from the modern world and probably never will return, as dreams in Western society have become a commodity of a very specific nature. They have entered Western science as a presumption of unsolvable crimes of the mind. Only a psychotherapist revealing the logic behind the seemingly unwanted patterns coming from, or driving for, chaos in time and space can defeat the trickster that hides behind the body of the dreamer. Deduction of the dream is as logical as the deduction of language seemingly is, or, as Holmes said to Watson while unraveling some scribbles on a piece of paper, "These hieroglyphs have evidently a meaning. If it is a purely arbitrary one, it may be impossible for us to solve it. If, on the other hand, it is systematic, I have no doubt we shall get to the bottom of it." So much so did Carl Gustav Jung face at one time or another after he traumatically divorced Freud, or rather Freud divorced him, the chaos of the universe. There it was, just waiting as a voice that keeps silence for another commanding voice. But where to begin? The concept of the unconscious had no history, no here and now, no future except a neurotic one, and a body that consisted mainly of sexual urges and censorship, as Freud had established. This last reduction was the first that needed to be dismantled, as it sort of filled the gap between origin and action, thereby leaving little room for speculation. What needed to be frontiered was this huge semantic space, as Umberto Eco once defined the reality of certain complex normal verbal units. To Jung, it was indeed a linguistic problem, a matter of systematization and verbalization of the image into the text. Hence, it was a matter of getting the shape into shape. The unconscious seemed chaotic, but it had to contain order. And thus Jung started the work of alchemistic semantics. And for years he constructed a philological pattern of meaning concerning every name, god, item, subject, animal, thing, figure, number that ever appeared in Western mythology. He truly would have been a great anthropologist would it not have been for his naturalistic conviction and his urge to make individual bodies subjected to what he came to call the collective unconscious. They, we and I, had little choice but to regard Jung's pattern as real and live according to the rules of this collective unconscious, as it was supposedly natural. Called or uncalled for, God will be there, Jung had engraved above the door of his house. As it seemed, his life and work was directed towards the emancipation of religion, or as many came to believe. Freud's theory concerning sexual content and intent of the dream was considered by Jung as a reduction of the religious needs of the dreamer. In his final letter to Freud, Jung wrote he wanted to help Freud, but Freud did not want to be saved. On the surface, indeed, Jung emancipated religion, as he disconnected it from church dogmas and institutions. He also strove hard to get Maria into her rightful place among the pantheon of gods. There had to be four instead of three, and she had to be part of it, in spite of the fact that she was still outnumbered by the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I also regard this type of emancipation highly questionable. Creating kings, queens, and gods to crown a kingdom usually makes emancipation impossible. For what we should know by now in anthropology, as well as in linguistics and psychoanalysis, the kingdom of culture can become dictatorship in a split second, especially if its processes are considered natural. And furthermore, no creature is born in order to be obedient, as, I would argue, this makes the essential process of life quite superfluous. Neither is emancipation a process of creating limited religious images for past identification. Jung might have declared Maria holy, but I for one resent that one of the most oppressing gender constructions concerning women has been placed on the throne ruling her gender. It reminds me of some types of cultural relativism that arose in the post-colonial period, in which it seemed anthropologists have accepted the culture of the eternal other, not out of tolerance, but because crowning the other creates a culture of oppression which does a so much better job than colonialism ever would. For a long time, I truly did believe Jung held some key elements in the process that became known and was named by him as individuation, the magic word, and also creativity, another magic word. Both words, thoughts, and performances are not of the same as unmotivated images or creative processes, as Goethe has shown. And Jung certainly had a hard time distinguishing the words from the reality, time, to which they seem to refer. On the one hand, he managed to show that the image of God had changed over time, and, in his analysis of Job's despair, he allowed man, for once, to shape God. But the lack of distinction between words, thoughts, and deeds remained, and from that arose a biblical mythonym between the creation of the text and its interpretation of the dream. So, too, in his own psychiatric practice. It is one thing to write about an ideal relationship between the psychotherapist and his patient, proclaiming transference and projection to be the keystone of a therapeutic process, stressing the importance of intimacy and the affectionate relationship of trust, keeping an open mind towards the patient and such. It is, however, quite another thing to practice psychoanalysis, that is, to be the voice of the master when speaking, to disfigure the patient's needs with his or her deeds, or to drive the patient crazy by plain listening, that is, supposing the possibility of a non-verbal zero degree of omnipresence. In short, it is different to write about a relationship in which power seems to be dissolved and to practice a relationship in which the relationship of power is dictated by the terms of the agreement. There is no guarantee in a psychotherapeutic relationship for a balance of power. Jung himself has put it aptly when he proclaimed that the right means in the hands of the wrong man become the wrong means. However, Jung left out the implication that this means, which can also easily become the wrong means, leaves the patients to be a sitting duck at the mercy of the right man, and therefore are the wrong means. Basically, it is not my intention to falsify the purpose or the motivation behind psychotherapy. Many people believe themselves to have benefited from therapeutic experiences, and many therapists do excellent jobs. However, psychoanalysis still remains at the level of a highly isolated and limited set of individual characteristics. It is unable to cross any cultural boundaries in spite of its pretense, and still dominated by conceptions of health and illness that center on the idea of functioning properly within society. Whose or what that society entails becomes very questionable where cultural variety is concerned. Though some scientific attempts have been made, most cross-cultural interpretation, usually labeled as ethnopsychiatry or any other variation of psychology labels, still consider the findings of Freud and Jung to be dominating in the patterns of cultural behavior. This persistent prejudice has, according to my research on the position of Afro-Surinamese minorities within the Dutch healthcare system, resulted in large numbers of victims among the different ethnic groups in the Netherlands. Next to this, following the work of Foucault, psychiatry is connected with a history of impotence regarding the unknown, the extraordinary, and last but not least, the unpredictable behavior of individuals. In this sense, it has equally resulted in a history of power, that is, a history of healing strategies that are characterized by force. Among these strategies are all the more or less shock-devised therapies, ranging from dropping patients into ice-cold water to electroshock appliances. Oppressive techniques, which are less acknowledged in general, are those techniques that try to gain access in the inner core of the patient's being, aimed at character changes. Suggestion, hypnosis, inviting transference, counter-authority in its range and infinite shapes are exactly those means that can become the wrong means in the hands of the wrong person and the right person. Simultaneously, those who are free of powers of wrongs could cast the first stone. All these elements of power and oppression causes the psychiatrist to maintain the role of an interpreter, regulator of society, conveying at the same time the principal clones, images, and performances on how individuals should be. The image making, as well as the stress on performance and functioning, is truly part and parcel of the Western world. On the one hand, this image making, performance and functioning is largely the result of the capitalist and post-capitalist economy of the body. As I try to explain Karl Popper, this economy of the body has developed along the lines of Darwinian views, in which living things are classified on the merits of their function concerning production, reproduction, and selection in terms of suitability. Suitability here refers to breeding programs and evolution theories in accordance to the functions that needed to be performed. On the other hand, this image-making also is the result of a dominance of things, which entail a hegemony of the visual as a means of knowing and thinking, as Steven Tyler explains in The Vision Quest of the West. In Western sciences, the visual mode of production is dominant over all the other senses. Unlimited examples can be found anywhere, for instance, seeing is believing, and an eyewitness, and or no witness. What is to be seen is the thing itself, its physical shape, that is. But without its physical shape, its seeable form, it seems comprised of nothing, Steven Tyler points out. The whole history of psychology documents the search for and failure to find such substantial and seeable things as memory traces, engrams, and stimuli. And what we can conclude about an anthropology that looks at culture as if it was watching a bug, or a philosophy that seeks the souls of ideas and conditions to life as if it is on a journey to discover the Nile. This dominance of the visual sensory mode is extremely prevalent in Jung's work. In fact, his entire theory is built on visualizing the shape of things to prove the existence of the collective unconscious, as well as the traces of a collective memory. This tilted idea and dominance of the visual mode, according to Steven Tyler, at the expense of the verbal, has also resulted in the pathological reduction of voice hearing, a phenomena which Jung indeed regards as more psychotic than the dreams and visions which serve the therapeutic process. Recent research has shown that only 2% of all registered, between brackets, voice hearers have pathological problems with regard to their observations. It seems also quite unclear where this revival of images from the alchemistic treatise leads to. It has been known for quite some time that, depending on the orientation of the psychiatrist, patients have a tendency to dream in Freudian or Jungian or Adlerian images. This part of the process of communication between the therapist and the patient has direct bearings on individual body perception. The tradition that abstract these images reduces the possibility of individual developmental process and brings the patient into an accepted state of happiness. In Jung's case, the density of the images making, a top-heavy density, could just as well be the result of an abolition of any change or emancipation. How important is the dominance of these images? The irony of Jung's revival of images may be that there has been quite a number of individuals in the first decades of this century who were preoccupied with getting rid of all these old images. It existed simultaneously alongside Jung's image-making and did exactly the opposite of what they were expected to do. Among them, Kandinsky, Man Ray, and many others. They experimented and celebrated form with the aim to free it of its naturalist connotation. Kandinsky by eliminating the form altogether in favor of the composition. Man Ray by creating surrealism, realism and naturalism extended in such a way that they cease to be real. The opposition towards these tendency consisted mainly of naturalists and traditionalists, and, as is usually the case with all individual shapeshifters, the general public did not like them at first, though today they are celebrated artists. Kandinsky writes, looking back at his early work, "In those days I still believed that the public viewer would approach a painting with an open mind to trace it in a familiar speech. Such contemplators exist. That is not a fantasy. It is just that they are as rare as grains of gold among the sand. But I indeed encountered them in my life." And Man Ray drove his manager crazy by getting bored or passing beyond one type of work once the general public got interested. Such seems the irony, too, of individuals, that they can be opposed at large, in spite of Jung's celebrated trial of individuation. The answer to the why of this question needs to be found in the methods of representation. The question on what Jung's concept of individuation implies for individual body perception is a matter of a tilted sense perception of the West, which is fully incorporated by the methods of representation. And so, I write to Carl Gustav Jung.